28. Tokyo, Japan, September 11th, 1945, morning. The war will never be over for Hideki Tojo. The diminutive 60-year-old former Japanese prime minister hides in plain sight, waiting patiently for American soldiers to arrest him for war crimes. He could try to make a run for it, but Tojo is a careful and thoughtful tactician, despite his reputation as a madman. Unlike the visages of the German Nazis now being smuggled into South America, there to live a life of apprehensive anonymity, Tojo's is one of the most well-known faces in the world. He is famous. He is wanted, and he is unmistakably Japanese. There is not a single place on earth he could hide. So Tojo remains in his farmhouse on the outskirts of Tokyo, keeping a pistol close at all times. He has even had his physician paint a small black target on his chest, just to make sure that he will not miss when the time comes to put a bullet through his heart. American soldiers and sailors have been pouring into Japan by the thousands, disarming the Japanese military, spiking naval guns, and removing the propellers from airplanes. Thus begins the long, slow process of healing the great divide between America and Japan. In China, 40,000 United States Marines, many of whom landed on the bloody shores of Peleliu and survived those horrendous months of battle 1 year ago, are en route to the north, where they will serve garrison duty and accept the surrender of Japanese units that have not yet fallen to the Russians. Many Japanese forces in China have never before suffered defeat in battle. The act of laying down their arms and burning their regimental standards will be bitter and humiliating. The war may be over, but there are still scores to settle. Arguably, both Japanese and American forces committed horrendous acts in the name of winning the war. General Curtis LeMay believes that if America had lost, his decision to firebomb Tokyo would most certainly have seen him indicted for war crimes. But it is the victor who metes out the final punishment. Just as the Nazi leadership is about to go on trial in Nuremberg, so too will Japan's generals and diplomats be held accountable for their acts of terror. The encrypted messages the Imperial Guard headquarters sent to field units in August ordering the burning of all documentation pertaining to the treatment of prisoners of war, comfort women, chemical and biological warfare, and the illicit drug trade did not lead to the destruction of all evidence. Foreseeing the need for war crimes documentation as far back as 1942, MacArthur ordered the U.S. Army's Allied Translator and Interpreter Section, ATIS, to comb captured documents for evidence of atrocities. By war's end on September 2nd, ATIS is in possession of more than 350,000 such files. ATIS Commander Colonel Sidney Mashbeer was able to confront Katsuo Okazaki of Japan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs with photographic proof that Japanese soldiers were ordered to burn and maim thousands of innocent Filipinos during the fall of Manila. "And do you have the names of the soldiers responsible for these atrocities?" Okazaki asked, hoping to call Mashbeer's bluff. "You're damn right," the colonel replied angrily. "Depend on it, you will very shortly be called upon to turn them over to us for punishment." There is no telling how many thousands of Japanese diplomats and soldiers will be forced to stand trial for war crimes, ranging from murder and rape to mistreatment of prisoners of war. Strangely, however, the most heinous Japanese war criminal is completely ignored by Allied prosecutors. In fact, in the almost 2 weeks since the surrender was signed and the occupation began, General Hideki Tojo has yet to encounter a single American. Day after day passes with no visit from the military police. There have been times when it seemed the Americans might not be coming at all. But Tojo knows he is a special case. As the man who led Japan into war against the United States, who personally oversaw every last detail of the Pearl Harbor bombing, and who happily encouraged his commanders to murder prisoners of war, he is far too notorious to escape indictment. Execution will be another matter entirely, for he refuses to be taken alive. Tojo does not have the courage to kneel on the floor, write his final death statement and thrust a razor-sharp knife into his abdomen. But a .32-caliber Colt automatic pistol is quicker and just as lethal. Incredibly, if not for two brash American journalists who knocked on Tojo's front door yesterday, the U.S. Army might still be looking for him. To the great surprise of Merlin Spencer and Russell Brines of the Associated Press, Tojo was only too happy to grant them an exclusive interview. It was Tojo's last chance to tell his side of the story before killing himself. He reveled in the discussion, chain-smoking as the journalists peppered him with questions. No subject, with the exception of the coming war crimes trials, was off-limits. The shaven-headed one-time terror of Asia, the Americans wrote under a shared byline, was willing to talk of many things, the mood ranging from steely-eyed impassivity to hearty laughter. As Tojo knew it would be, the interview was published in newspapers around the world. Now, looking out his farmhouse window, Tojo sees that one of the journalists has returned, bringing along a photographer. They appear to be waiting for something to happen, for neither man is making any attempt to approach the house. Sure enough, two American Army vehicles soon come to a stop in front of the farmhouse. Tojo counts five soldiers who have come to take him away, each of them armed. One of them spots Tojo looking out the window, causing the group to move quickly toward the front door. Tojo slides open the window and yells to the crowd, "I am Tojo!" Tojo has little time. He closes the window, unbuttons his shirt, places his loaded .32-caliber Colt automatic to the black mark on his chest, and pulls the trigger. With a resounding bang, a bullet is launched into Tojo's heart. Blood pours from the wound. Every element of Tojo's suicide plan has been staged to absolute perfection. Every element except one. The bullet almost completely missed his heart. Hideki Tojo is not dead. Lieutenant John Wilpers hears the gunshot. The 25-year-old Army intelligence officer rushes up the steps and kicks open Tojo's front door. General Douglas MacArthur personally ordered the 308th Counterintelligence Corps to arrest Tojo this morning, and Wilpers plans on carrying out that order to the best of his ability. To Lieutenant Wilpers, a dead Tojo just won't do. Footnote: Wilpers will be awarded the Bronze Star for his actions at Tojo's farmhouse on September 11, 1945. However, the Army will lose his paperwork, so he will not physically receive the honor until he is 90 years old. End footnote. But the former Prime Minister certainly looks near death. He is splayed on a chair, his chest rising and falling faintly. Photographer Charlie Gorey of the Associated Press has followed Wilpers through the farmhouse door and begins taking pictures as Lieutenant Wilpers unholsters his sidearm and points it at Tojo, who has begun to apologize for taking so long to die. Taking possession of the dying man's .32, Wilpers immediately begins the desperate search for a doctor. Orders are orders. Tojo must remain alive. 6 days after Tojo's attempted suicide on September 17, 1945, the young ensign from Brooklyn is terrified that a typhoon may sink his ship 800 miles southwest of Tokyo. The USS Oneida has just arrived in Okinawa's Hagushi Bay after 5 days in Jinshin, Korea. But the approaching typhoon is chasing the ship back out to sea. There is every chance Oneida will survive the winds and rain if she remains in port here in Okinawa, but a similar storm just last week showed that it is better to be cautious. Typhoon Ursula, as it was known, blasted through the Sea of Japan with winds registering more than 100 miles per hour. Aircraft transporting American prisoners of war homeward were caught in the deadly storm. Tragically, these men who had endured years of torture and starvation would never see America again. All 900 of them died when the storm forced 30 airplanes to crash into the Sea of Japan. Footnote: there were no survivors, making it the worst peacetime aviation disaster in history. End footnote. Ursula is still fresh in the minds of Oneida's crew as she powers away from Hagushi Bay as quickly as possible. A second typhoon, known as Ida, is also bearing down on the busy wartime port. The fast attack transport will stand a better chance of avoiding damage if it can outrace the storms. Ultimately, Ida will be even more deadly than Ursula. She is destined to slam hard into the Japanese mainland, there to be renamed Makurazaki. The city of Hiroshima, still a wasteland 5 weeks after the dropping of the atomic bomb, will be swamped by tidal waves and flooding. 3,000 more residents will die, 6,000 more homes will be destroyed, and 50,000 homes will be flooded. In any other time, this would be a catastrophe of global significance. But in the wake of the millions of lives lost from nations worldwide in the Pacific War and the more than 100,000 already dead from the atomic bombs, the typhoon damage will receive scant newspaper coverage. The tall ensign from Brooklyn, who recently graduated from the College of the Holy Cross in Massachusetts, came aboard the Oneida 10 months ago. As with the other sailors, he goes through the daily routines of life on board the ship. 4-hour watch, regular meals in the officer's mess, and the utter off-duty boredom that defines life at sea. Soon, the Oneida will take part in the joyous exodus known as Operation Magic Carpet. Hundreds of U.S. ships, even massive aircraft carriers, are clearing their decks for the thousands of soldiers, sailors, and Marines who need a lift home. After enduring a brutal period of war, these men and women deserve nothing but the best, and the ensign knows it. Back in Brooklyn, after months of uncertainty and countless prayers, the ensign's father and mother are waiting to see him walk through their front door. But that will not happen soon. There is still work to do in Japan. He has been ordered ashore to help rebuild the defeated nation. On November 26th, he will begin a 6-month tour of duty at the Naval Communications Facility in Yokosuka, working for Radio Tokyo. It is the ideal job for a young man blessed with an easy wit and a way with words. Whether or not he will be released from the Navy after that, or be forced to serve another year or two, is unknown. It is 10 a.m. on September 27, 1945, as a nervous and preoccupied Emperor Hirohito steps out of his maroon 1930 Rolls-Royce at the entrance of the American Embassy in Tokyo. Footnote: maroon is the color reserved for imperial vehicles. Hirohito has long had a passion for the Rolls-Royce, and this is one of many he has owned. End footnote. The Emperor's War, like those of Tojo and the young ensign from Brooklyn, is not over. Hirohito is depressed, and his hands tremble. He suffers from severe jaundice that has deepened the sallow pallor of his skin. Last night he lay awake, worrying he will have to stand next to Tojo in the prisoner's dock, listening to the sonorous tones of an American prosecutor listing his many war crimes. Taking a deep breath, Hirohito momentarily calms his fears. Perhaps he won't hang after all. His only hope is a direct appeal to General Douglas MacArthur, which is why the Emperor has traveled to the American Embassy this morning. Courage is everything right now, even if it is false. The Emperor could have saved himself days of worry by greeting MacArthur a week ago. Hirohito's Imperial Palace is just across the street from MacArthur's brand-new office headquarters in Tokyo's Daiichi Seimei building. Footnote: Daiichi means number one in Japanese. In addition to its proximity to the Imperial Palace and the fact that it is one of the few prominent buildings in Tokyo still standing after the American bombings, this linguistic symbolism is a prime reason Douglas MacArthur chose this insurance office as the epicenter of America's almighty control of Japanese life and culture. End footnote. When he moved in, MacArthur gave the Daiichi Life Insurance Company 3 days to vacate the imposing structure, then chose for himself a simple 6th-floor office that actually looks down onto the Imperial Palace. While Hirohito can see MacArthur's office just by looking out the window, and MacArthur can just as easily see him, the Emperor has waited for MacArthur to make the first move. But the general is cunning. Paying a call upon the Emperor would have been seen as subservient. better to have it the other way around. MacArthur is a message sender, and this message says the Emperor has no clothes. MacArthur has designated that the meeting should take place at the American Embassy, allowing the people of Tokyo plenty of opportunity to see the Emperor's unmistakable rolls making the shameful drive to MacArthur's residence. The Emperor's journey from the Sakurada Gate of the Imperial Palace southward through the decimated streets of Tokyo has taken less than 10 minutes. His imperial sedan has been followed by 3 black Mercedes loaded with members of the royal court, but the Emperor pays little attention to them now. Clad in a black waistcoat, top hat, and polished dress shoes, Hirohito steps through the American Embassy's front door. He is unused to commoners touching his personal possessions and immediately recoils as 2 army officers salute him and then step forward to take his hat. "You are very, very welcome, sir," says a grinning MacArthur, striding into the room to break the ice. He wears his normal daily khaki uniform rather than formal wear and has not even affixed his combat ribbons to the simple creased shirt. The general thrusts out his hand to greet the Emperor, but Hirohito bows low at the same time, leaving MacArthur's open hand hovering awkwardly above the Emperor's head. Hirohito continues to bow, finally extending his hand upward to clasp MacArthur's. After a moment's hesitation, MacArthur invites Hirohito and his interpreter into a private room. The 2 men speak for 40 minutes, during which the Emperor apologizes for the war, an admission MacArthur actually downplays during their conversation. This is the first of 11 meetings that will take place between MacArthur and Hirohito over the next several years, but it is the most important. For in this simple mid-morning conversation, MacArthur makes it clear that he sees the Emperor as vital to forging an alliance that will successfully rebuild Japan. Even though the Emperor's admission of culpability makes him a Class A war criminal, MacArthur will do everything in his considerable power to make sure Hirohito never sees the inside of a jail cell, or feels the coarse braid of a hangman's noose around his throat. At meeting's end, MacArthur's personal photographer is shown into the room. It was Captain Gaetano Failasi who snapped the iconic image of the general wading ashore in the Philippines 6 months ago, and now he snaps another photo for the ages. Failasi actually takes 3 pictures of MacArthur and Hirohito standing side by side in front of a desk. In the first 2, MacArthur's eyes are closed and Hirohito appears to be yawning. But the 3rd image, the one that will forever remind the Japanese people that their emperor no longer rules Japan, is the keeper. The 6-foot MacArthur towers over Hirohito, looking dominant and unimpressed by the small man to his left. The emperor stands at stiff attention. MacArthur looks casual, hands on his hips and elbows sticking out from his sides, like a random American tourist who has somehow stumbled into the emperor's inner sanctum. Just to make sure the message is received loud and clear, MacArthur orders that the photos be released to the newspapers, so that all of Japan can see the towering Gaijin who now rules their nation. Predictably, the people of Japan are horrified. 3 months later, on January 1, 1946, at MacArthur's urging, Emperor Hirohito repudiates his divine status, admitting to the people of Japan that he is not a god. Thus, the divine nature of the Japanese ruler is revealed as a fraud. But that admission comes far too late for millions of the dead scattered across Asia. It is May 3, 1946. Formal war crimes indictments are being read at the International Military Tribunal for the Far East in a Tokyo courtroom. These Tokyo trials will see a team of jurists hearing evidence against the accused war criminals. With the exception of Judge Radhabinod Pal of India, who considers the proceedings formalized vengeance sought with arrogance by the Allied powers upon a defeated Japan, the verdicts against the accused will be authoritative. 7 men will be sentenced to death for Class A war crimes, 16 others will be imprisoned for life, and 2 others will be imprisoned for shorter periods of time. Footnote: 25 of the 28 men charged as Class A war criminals in the Tokyo trials were convicted. In addition, Allied prosecutors will hold tribunals against Japanese generals, diplomatic officials, soldiers, and camp guards at several other locations throughout Asia and the Pacific. The British were particularly vigilant in prosecuting those men who killed so many thousands in the construction of the Burma-Siam Railway. In addition to the 25 defendants convicted at the Tokyo trials, another 4,300 Japanese soldiers were found guilty of rape, abuse of POWs, and murder. 1,000 of these men will be sentenced to death. The rest will be given life imprisonment, although many of these sentences will be commuted. End footnote. Hideki Tojo is among those hearing the indictments. Thanks to the actions of Lieutenant John Wilpers, a doctor was quickly located after the former prime minister shot himself. However, this physician refused to treat Tojo, so the quick-thinking Wilpers was forced to find yet another doctor to save Tojo. After recovering in the hospital, Tojo has been living in solitary confinement in Tokyo's Sugamo prison under round-the-clock armed guard. Now, as Tojo sits in the docket, a deranged Japanese civilian defendant hoping to plead insanity steps forward and slaps him twice on the back of the head. The Prime Minister finds this funny and smiles openly, despite the ominous nature of the proceedings. There is another bit of bizarre humor that will shortly come into play, of which Tojo will be completely unaware. The war criminal wears false teeth, and during his time in prison he will come to require a new set of dentures. The United States will be only too happy to oblige. But unbeknownst to Tojo, the words, "Remember Pearl Harbor," will be drilled into the false teeth in Morse code, ensuring that the Second World War will never really be over for Hideki Tojo, especially not late at night when he lies alone in solitary confinement at Sugamo Prison, running his tongue along his new dentures, wondering about the curious bumps and divots studding the otherwise smooth porcelain surfaces. 29. The White House, Washington, D.C., winter 1948, daytime. The Second World War has been over for almost 3 years as Colonel Paul Tibbetts steps into the Oval Office. The veteran pilot is among 4 men the president has spontaneously invited for a short visit. Tibbetts, along with General Carl Spatz, General Jimmy Doolittle, and Colonel Dave Shillen, made the short drive from the Pentagon together, whereupon they were ushered into the president's office without delay. They have no idea why they have been summoned. Tibbetts, the Enola Gay pilot, has been busy since World War II ended. He flew home from the Pacific to minor adulation, but quickly withdrew from the public, preferring instead to focus on his failing marriage and the continuation of his aviation career. Back in September 1945, with the war newly ended and American troops flooding into Japan, Tibbetts was among the first pilots to fly into Tokyo with the occupation forces. Almost immediately upon being billeted at the Daiichi Building next to the Imperial Palace in downtown Tokyo, where Douglas MacArthur would also locate his headquarters, Tibbetts received orders to transport a Japanese physicist to Hiroshima so that the man could study the A-bomb's aftermath. This would be the only time in his life that Tibbetts would get a chance to visit the scene of Enola Gay's destruction. But fate intervened. The runway near Hiroshima was unsuitable for landing a large aircraft, so instead, Tibbetts delivered Professor Masao Tsuzuki to Nagasaki and then spent 3 days there with a small group of crew he had flown with on Enola Gay. Tibbetts and his fellow aviators were touched by the friendliness of the Japanese people, struggling to reconcile that new behavior with the frenzied mobs that had been known to attack and kill downed American flyers. Colonel Tibbetts, Bombardier Major Tom Farabee, and Navigator Captain Theodore Dutch Van Kirk slept along the waterfront in an idyllic hotel with bamboo walls and a thatched roof. Tibbetts could not help but note that the location was also the aiming point for the Nagasaki bomb. The quaint inn would not exist were it not for the heavy clouds that caused boxcar to drop its payload miles off target. The American officers are awed by Fat Man's destruction. Block after block had been flattened, as if by a tornado. Strangely, however, I saw no signs of death. There were no bodies anywhere, Tibbetts later wrote. The brief visit left me with considerable respect for the people who had been our enemies such a short time before. President Truman is not at his desk when Tibbetts, Spots, Doolittle, and Shillen enter the Oval Office. The question of whether or not it was ethical to drop the atomic bombs still hangs over this hallowed room, as it will for decades to come. Strangely, just three chairs await the four Air Force officers. One man must remain standing. The most powerful officer in the group is Spots, who has recently been selected the first Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force. In July 1945, it was Spots who requested a handwritten order authorizing the dropping of the atomic bomb. Protocol demands that the chair farthest to the right belongs to him. Doolittle, whose flying career is perhaps the most legendary, led the 1942 bombing of Tokyo that became known as simply the Doolittle Raid. As the second highest ranking of the group, the general will be seated to Spots's left in the middle chair. Colonel Shillen and Tibbetts are of equal rank. It remains unclear which of them will sit and which will stand. White House butler Alonzo Fields quickly takes charge. General Spots, Fields says, gesturing to a chair, will you please be facing the desk? As expected, Spots takes the seat farthest to the right. Tibbetts remains standing. After almost 15 years in the military, he knows better than to ask questions. Following strict orders from the president, the White House butler shocks Tibbetts by guiding him around to the opposite side of the presidential desk and gesturing to a chair facing the other three, right next to where Truman will sit. A surprised Paul Tibbetts takes a seat. The men are served coffee as they await the president's arrival. 10 minutes later, Harry Truman walks in wearing a huge smile. The officers immediately rise. Sit down, Truman orders jovially, making everyone feel at ease. Since taking office 4 years ago, the president has transformed himself from a piano-playing vice president into one of the world's great statesmen. Which is not to say that the transition from war to peacetime has been easy. The tension between the United States and the Soviet Union that began in the waning days of World War II continues to escalate as Russia relentlessly seeks to expand communist influence around the world. The sense of power Truman felt in Potsdam back in 1945 when he informed Joseph Stalin that America possessed a superweapon has long since dimmed, and intelligence reports estimate it is only a matter of time before the Soviet Union develops an atomic bomb of its own. Footnote: the Soviet Union successfully exploded its first atomic weapon on August 29, 1949. End footnote. In addition to the troubles with Russia, Truman's outspoken personality has alienated some voters here in America. Many point to the slowing economy as a sign that he is a poor leader. With his job approval ratings sometimes dropping below 40%, there is a widespread belief that Harry Truman will not run for re-election, and that he would lose in a landslide should he choose to. There have, however, been some victories for Truman. His unilateral selection of Douglas MacArthur as Supreme Commander of the Allied Powers in 1945 is popular. MacArthur has successfully transformed a former enemy into a burgeoning ally, rebuilding Japan from rubble and preventing it from embracing communism like so many of its Asian neighbors. Privately, Truman now believes the appointment was a mistake. He no longer trusts the general's decision-making, believing MacArthur's ego has turned Japan into his own personal fiefdom. But for now, Truman keeps his opinion to himself. Still smiling, Truman begins the brief meeting by looking at the row of Air Force officers assembled across the desk. General Spots, I want to congratulate you on being the first Chief of the Air Force, says the President. Thank you, sir, Spots replies. It is a great honor, and I appreciate it. Turning his gaze to Doolittle, Truman congratulates him on the legendary 1942 raid over Tokyo, which shocked the Japanese because heavy American bombers were launched from aircraft carriers, a feat once considered impossible. That was a magnificent thing you pulled, flying off that carrier, Truman marvels. All in a day's work, Mr. President, replies the ever-confident Doolittle. To Shillen, Truman shows that he is keeping abreast of post-war aviation technology. Colonel Shillen, I want to congratulate you on having the foresight to recognize the potential in aerial refueling. We're going to need it bad someday. Thank you very much, sir. Finally, Harry Truman turns to face Colonel Paul Tibbets. The president says nothing at first, letting their shared moment form a connection. For 10 long seconds, the president does not speak. What do you think? Truman finally asks. Mr. President, Tibbets replies, knowing full well what Harry Truman is talking about. I think I did what I was told. Truman slaps his hand down on the desk, rattling the legendary "The Buck Stops Here" placard placed there after the war. You're damn right you did. And I'm the guy who sent you. More than 8 months later, and 20 minutes before midnight in Tokyo's Sugamo prison, Buddhist priest and prison chaplain Shinso Hanayama, the spiritual advisor to the 7 Class A Japanese war criminals who will hang by the neck until dead tonight, shares a last moment with each man in the prison's Buddhist chapel. The date is December 22, 1948. 2 American chaplains will witness the executions, but Hanayama will not be allowed inside the death chamber. So as each man leaves the Buddhist ceremony, the priest says goodbye to mass murderers like General Hideki Tojo and former Prime Minister Koki Hirota. A party of 9 witnesses will be on hand to watch the war's final chapter unfold. A total of 20 executioners, guards, jailers, and legal officials will view the hangings. The loved ones of the condemned men have not been invited. Each of the observers in the chamber is under strict instructions not to display unseemly conduct or take photographs. The execution order states that the hangings will take place as soon after midnight on December 23rd as possible. The Sugamo prison execution chamber is so small that there is only 1 room for 4 nooses, so the war criminals must be hanged in 2 separate shifts. As the clock ticks toward 12, each criminal is clothed in the uniform of an American Army garbageman, devoid of any military insignia. The men's legs are shackled, and waist belts are wrapped around their torsos. Each prisoner will be accompanied to the gallows by 2 American guards. The first group of 4 men is comprised of Generals Kenji Doihara, Iwani Matsui, Akira Muto, and Hideki Tojo. Footnote. General Kenji Doihara is the opium-addicted commander who led the invasion of Manchuria and the subsequent subjugation of the Chinese people. General Iwani Matsui is charged with leading the rape of Nanking. General Akira Muto was responsible for inhumane activities in China, Sumatra, and the Philippines. And Hideki Tojo was the Japanese prime minister responsible for leading Japan into war. End footnote. Leg irons clanking, the column of men is marched to the gallows and up the 13 steps to the platform. The executioner stands at one end. His 3 assistants place a black hood over the head of each condemned man. Nooses are then lowered over the hoods and cinched snugly across their throats. The process will be repeated for the second group to be hanged. General Seishiro Itagaki, Koki Hirota, and General Haitaro Kimura. Footnote. General Seishiro Itagaki was convicted on 8 counts of war crimes, including inhumane treatment of prisoners of war. Former Prime Minister Koki Hirota was in power when Japan invaded China and was sentenced for the attack and subsequent proliferation of the war. General Haitaro Kimura was an assistant to Tojo and also went on to commands throughout Asia. He was charged with allowing the barbaric treatment of Allied POWs to proliferate. End footnote. The hangings take place 29 minutes apart. The Buddhist priest Shinso Hanayama will write that he could hear the trapdoors swing open at 12:01 a.m. and again at 12:30 a.m. Within 90 seconds of climbing the gallows, each man is swinging from a rope. The bodies are then removed and cremated, the ashes dispersed so that no memorial shrine might ever honor the men's lives. In his last words, Tojo, the man responsible for the millions who died in the Pacific during World War II, says he is sorry. The once arrogant and bloodthirsty Prime Minister is reduced to a broken man. Thus, 2 days before Christmas, the Japanese brutalizers are no more, closing one of the most violent eras the world has ever known. Footnote. Like the bodies of the 6 other men executed on December 23, 1948, Tojo's body was cremated. Despite the best efforts of the Americans, his ashes were split between a Tokyo cemetery and the Yasukuni Shrine, a still controversial memorial to the glorious Japanese war dead. Displays at the nearby Yushukan Military Museum espouse a revisionist history, claiming that the United States was the racist aggressor in the Greater East Asia War, as the Pacific Theater of the Second World War is known in Japan. Shortly before his sentence was carried out, Tojo gave his military ribbons to one of his American jailers. End footnote.
Chapter 30. New York, New York, September 10th, 1949, 9 a.m. The young ensign from Brooklyn looks at his brunette wife, who is holding their newborn son. The baby is big, more than 10 pounds. The ensign has been back from the Pacific for more than 2 years and is now starting a new life, father and provider. William James O'Reilly hopes his new son will follow in the tradition of his ancestors, hardworking Irish Catholics who value family and loyalty over money and material things. He and his bride of just over a year, Angela, are thrilled with their baby boy, whom they name Billy, William James O'Reilly, Jr. Bill and Angela married in New York City's St. Patrick's Cathedral in 1948. She already had a good job as a physical therapist at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, located on Manhattan's Upper West Side. And it is there where baby Billy is born. Ensign O'Reilly, with a college degree from St. Francis College and military training at the College of the Holy Cross, is trying to decide on a career direction. Now, with the arrival of the baby, the urgency of that decision is more pronounced. The newlywed couple lives in a small apartment just over the George Washington Bridge in northern New Jersey. Money is tight. Already, the ensign is regretting leaving the Navy, where there is security and direction. Unlike many of his peers, Bill O'Reilly Sr. loved his time in the service. He learned much during the occupation of Japan, the experience bringing him a measure of respect for the Japanese people, who, in his opinion, endured the occupation with discipline. Soon, the ensign will move his wife and baby to the teeming New York City suburb of Levittown on Long Island. Here, inexpensive housing is being built en masse, and mortgages for veterans are favorable. The price for a Spartan 2-bedroom home is $8,000. Both Bill and Angela will live there until they die. My father was always nostalgic for the Navy and fascinated by World War II. He firmly believed he would have been killed if MacArthur's land invasion had come to fruition. His ship, the USS Oneida, was set to ferry hundreds of Marines close to the beaches of Japan. Only later did my father find out that thousands of Japanese kamikaze pilots were waiting to attack the U.S. fleet. The carnage would have been devastating. And so it is that Ensign O'Reilly, his wife and their 2 children, my sister Janet arriving 2 years later, built yet another traditional American family over the decades of the 1950s and 60s. My dad never prospered in the marketplace, keeping his job as a low-level financial analyst for almost 30 years. As a child of the Great Depression, he valued a steady paycheck more than anything. Thus, he settled for a pedestrian job and allowed his vast talents for communication to go undeveloped. Not usually introspective, my father was convinced of one certainty, which he shared with me on a few occasions, that his very existence, and therefore my life as well, was likely saved by a terrible bomb and a gut-wrenching presidential decision that is still being debated to this day. But for the young ensign and his present-day son, there really is no debate. Only a stark reality. Had the A-bombs not been used, you would very likely not be reading this book.
Postscript. Emperor Michinomiya Hirohito was stripped of all power by General Douglas MacArthur, However, the general felt that Hirohito was symbolically vital to healing the nation's post-war wounds. As such, MacArthur quietly decreed that Hirohito be absolved of all responsibility for war crimes. To maintain the ruse that the emperor was not directly involved in the war effort and its many atrocities, MacArthur and Hirohito collaborated to slant testimony of the war crimes defendants away from the emperor. In recent decades, revisionist historians in Japan have repudiated the notion that the emperor is not divine, suggesting that the wording of Hirohito's pronouncement was a vague gesture to placate the American occupiers. The occupation forces tried to sever the bond between the emperor and the Japanese people, reads a plaque at Tokyo's controversial Yasukuni Shrine and Museum. They widely advertised the New Year statement as the emperor's declaration of humanity, but in actuality, the emperor had done no more than to announce a return to the principles stated in Emperor Meiji's 1868 charter oath. Hirohito made a point of boycotting the Yasukuni Shrine in the heart of Tokyo after the war when he learned that the ashes of Japanese war criminals had secretly been enshrined there. In the 4 decades between the war's end and his death, Hirohito appeared regularly in public, greeting foreign heads of state during their visits to Tokyo and traveling abroad to meet with both Queen Elizabeth II of Great Britain and U.S. President Gerald Ford. In 1975, he famously had his photograph taken with an entirely different head of state, posing alongside Mickey Mouse during a visit to Disneyland in California. Emperor Hirohito died on January 7, 1989, at the age of 87, after reigning for 63 years. He is said to have been buried wearing a Mickey Mouse watch. Robert Oppenheimer became world famous once the atomic bombs were dropped and details of the Manhattan Project were released to the public. He appeared on the cover of both Time and Life magazines as the intellectual face of the dawning nuclear age. For a time, Oppenheimer tried to return to the academic world, but after realizing that his passion for teaching had waned, he accepted a position as director of a think tank known as the Institute for Advanced Study. He became an advocate for nuclear arms control. The explosion of a new weapon known as the hydrogen bomb in 1952 ushered in the new age of thermonuclear weapons that explode with a force exponentially surpassing the Hiroshima and Nagasaki blasts. These new weapons actually require an atomic reaction to trigger the greater thermonuclear detonation, leading to the saying, "All nuclear weapons are atomic, but not all atomic weapons are nuclear." Currently, 9 nations possess the power to wage nuclear war: the United States, Russia, Israel, the United Kingdom, France, China, Pakistan, India, and North Korea. In all, it is estimated there are 16,300 nuclear weapons in existence. Robert Oppenheimer's security clearance was suspended in 1953, then stripped altogether in 1954 after the FBI charged him with communist associations. A later examination of declassified files would show that Oppenheimer never betrayed the United States and had resisted several attempts by the Russian KGB to recruit him as a spy. However, this revelation came long after Oppenheimer's death from throat cancer on February 18, 1967, at the age of 62. His wife, Kitty, to whom he had remained married despite infidelities on his part, had his body cremated and his urn dropped into the sea just offshore from their beach home in the U.S. Virgin Islands. The house was subsequently destroyed in a storm, leaving the urn's exact resting place a mystery, much like Robert Oppenheimer himself. The effects of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were felt for decades. Both cities have been rebuilt in remarkable fashion, with almost all buildings possessing the same concrete and steel constitution as those structures that survived the initial blasts. In Hiroshima, the legendary A-bomb dome has become the most enduring symbol of the first atomic bomb. The T-shaped Aioi Bridge, which served as Enola Gay's aiming point, survived the bombing and remained in place for several years afterward. However, structural damage caused by the A-bomb eventually took its toll and the bridge was rebuilt. The former Gaibi Bank's Hiroshima location that survived the attack not only still exists, but is open to the public free of charge. The building is unchanged in many ways, and the teller windows have been replaced in their original positions. Visitors are welcome to walk the 9 steps up from the street and into the concrete and steel building to recreate Akiko Takakura's fortuitous early arrival at work on the morning of August 6, 1945. Nagasaki is less than 4 hours by bullet train to the southwest of Hiroshima. The rugged nature of the countryside is a subtle reminder that the Operation Olympic invasion would have required overcoming very formidable terrain. Nagasaki's bustling port and dockland are a popular port of call for cruise lines, cargo ships, and Japanese naval vessels. A large monument of polished stone 2 miles by streetcar from downtown Nagasaki, a stark contrast to the monument to the Hiroshima Hypocenter, a small plaque located in an alley with the words Enola Gay, misspelled as Enora Gay, marks the site of the A-bomb's hypocenter. Like Hiroshima, Nagasaki does not define itself by the atomic bomb. But both cities are tourist sites because of the explosions. Their local monuments and museums detailing the bomb's damage are well worth a visit. The father of the atomic age is Albert Einstein, whose famous 1905 equation E equals mc squared explains how mass is transformed into energy, thus theoretically making possible a nuclear explosion. The German-born physicist was visiting the United States in 1933 when Adolf Hitler rose to power. He chose not to return home due to the Third Reich's intolerance of Jews. At age 61, Einstein was granted U.S. citizenship in 1940. The year prior to that, he wrote a letter to President Franklin Roosevelt alerting him to Nazi Germany's hopes of developing a nuclear weapon. This led to the formation of the Manhattan Project, beginning the race between the United States and Germany to develop the first atomic bomb. Einstein, however, was not allowed to take part in the Manhattan Project. The FBI thought that Einstein's status as an avowed pacifist with liberal sympathies made him too great a security risk. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover maintained a secret file on Einstein, but was never able to prove that the physicist had communist ties. Many of Einstein's friends relocated to Los Alamos to take part in the project, and they made him well aware of its ongoing progress. In 1947, Einstein was working with the Emergency Committee of Atomic Scientists based in Princeton, New Jersey. As part of that group, he penned a letter that reads in part, "We scientists believe upon ample evidence that the time of decision is upon us, that what we do or fail to do within the next few years will determine the fate of our civilization. In the shadow of the atomic bomb, it has become apparent that all men are brothers. If we recognize this as truth and act upon this recognition, mankind may go forward to a higher plane of human development. If the angry passions of a nationalistic world engulf us further, we are doomed." Albert Einstein died in 1955 from an aortic aneurysm at the age of 76. His body was cremated, but only after his brain had been removed without permission by a Princeton hospital pathologist so that it might be studied for science. Colonel Paul Tibbets was dogged by controversy about the Hiroshima bombing for the rest of his life. However, he never backed down from his belief that he had done the right thing. The Enola Gay itself became an unlikely lightning rod for controversy when the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. planned to refurbish it after many years of neglect and place it on public display to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the war's end. Workers spent 2 decades and more than 300,000 man-hours to restore the plane to its original condition. The tone of the exhibit was to have been apologetic, suggesting that America was wrong to have dropped the atomic bomb and that as few as 31,000 American lives would have been lost in the first months of an invasion of Japan. Under pressure from veterans groups, the exhibit was altered to allow visitors to come up with their own interpretation of the ethics of dropping the bomb. The Enola Gay is now displayed at the National Air and Space Museum's Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center in Chantilly, Virginia. Boxcar, the aircraft from which the second atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki has also been lavishly restored. It is currently on display at the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. Both Colonel Tibbetts of Enola Gay and Major Chuck Sweeney of Boxcar were promoted to general during their long military careers. Tibbetts stayed in the Air Force and proved instrumental in pioneering the transition to jet-powered bomber flight. Sweeney left active duty after the Second World War, but continued to fly in the Massachusetts Air National Guard. Sweeney died in Boston in 2004 at the age of 84. Tibbetts lived to be 92 years old and requested that he be cremated rather than buried so that protesters might not make his gravesite a rallying point for anti-nuclear demonstrations. His ashes were scattered over the English Channel, over which he had flown many times during World War II. Mochitsuru Hashimoto, commander of the I-58 submarine that sank the Indianapolis, received word of the atomic bombings while still at sea. He and his crew thought the reports were just American propaganda. The submarine returned to port on August 15th, just in time to learn of the Japanese surrender. Though the war was over, Hashimoto was promoted and given command of the destroyer Yukikaze, tasked with traveling to China to bring Japanese troops home. However, the United States Navy, still reeling from the Indianapolis tragedy, summoned Hashimoto to America to testify in the court-martial proceedings of Captain Charles McVeigh. Hashimoto appeared in court in Washington, D.C. on December 11, 1945, and stated that there was nothing more McVeigh could have done to save his crew and that the captain was innocent of all charges. Despite this testimony, McVeigh was still found guilty. Hashimoto retired from the Japanese Navy shortly after his return to his homeland in 1946. He later followed in his father's footsteps and became a Shinto priest. He died on October 25, 2000, at the age of 91. Jean MacArthur, wife of General Douglas MacArthur, lived to be 101 years old. She died in New York City of natural causes in 2000, some 36 years after her husband's passing. She was instrumental in the building of the MacArthur Memorial, a museum and research center in Norfolk, Virginia, serving as chair of the board during its development and cutting the opening ribbon at the age of 91. In 1988, President Ronald Reagan presented Jean MacArthur with the Presidential Medal of Freedom. In 1994, during a visit to the United States, the Emperor and Empress of Japan paid a private visit to her New York apartment at the Waldorf Towers. She never remarried after the general's death and was buried at his side in the rotunda of the MacArthur Memorial in Norfolk. Arthur MacArthur IV, son of General Douglas MacArthur, is still alive, though his whereabouts have become an urban legend. At 77 years of age, he no longer goes by his given name, preferring instead to be called David Jordan. After being paid a $650,000 settlement to move out of his rent-controlled apartment in Manhattan's Mayflower Hotel in 2014, he relocated to Greenwich Village, where he is known to play the piano and avoid all contact with those wishing to associate him with the MacArthur name. Several future American presidents saw military service during World War II, among them naval officers James Earl Jimmy Carter and George Herbert Walker Bush. Carter, as a midshipman at the United States Naval Academy, was considered to be an active-duty serviceman during the war. He entered Annapolis in 1943 and graduated with the class of 1946. If the war had not ended, Carter would most certainly have been sent to the Pacific with his classmates as part of the naval invasion that would have been launched against Japan. Carter later served on the USS Mississippi, a battleship that had seen extensive service in the Pacific Theater. In 1948, he transitioned to submarines, where he served as one of the first group of sailors aboard nuclear submarines. Jimmy Carter was discharged from the Navy in 1953. George H.W. Bush, America's 41st president, joined the Navy in 1942 at the age of 18, earning his wings as a naval aviator before his 19th birthday. He was assigned to the Pacific Theater of Operations, where he would fly 58 combat missions during the war. On September 2, 1944, exactly 1 year to the day before the Japanese surrender, he was forced to bail out when his Avenger dive bomber was hit by enemy flak. Bush parachuted to safety, spending 4 hours afloat on a life raft before being rescued by an American submarine. He resumed flight operations and was based on the aircraft carrier USS San Jacinto. In December 1944, after 15 months of combat duty, he was reassigned to Naval Station Norfolk in Virginia, where he served as a flight instructor until his release from the Navy upon the Japanese surrender in September 1945. Both Presidents Bush and Carter were asked by Bill O'Reilly to give their opinions about President Truman's decision to drop the A-bomb. Their letters are included in this book for the first time, as is the opinion of President George W. Bush. Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama declined to give their opinions of Truman's actions. The relationship between Harry Truman and Douglas MacArthur did not have a happy ending. The last vestige of the war did not fade until April 28, 1952, when the American occupation of Japan was completed through a treaty signed in San Francisco and peace formally declared between the two nations. By then, Douglas MacArthur's tenure as Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers was long over. On June 25, 1950, the communist state of North Korea invaded its neighbor to the south, and MacArthur was named Commander of the United States and South Korean forces, charged with repelling the communist advance. The general successfully launched one of history's greatest amphibious invasions in September 1950, sending waves of troops ashore far behind enemy lines at Incheon and recapturing the South Korean capital of Seoul. In October 1950, President Harry Truman flew to Wake Island in the Pacific to meet with MacArthur about the status of the Korean War and present him with a Distinguished Service Medal, MacArthur's fifth. However, that meeting turned into a debacle. Truman was rankled that MacArthur delayed exiting from his plane for 45 minutes, effectively keeping the president waiting. In addition, MacArthur treated the president like an equal, shaking his hand rather than offering a salute when they first met. Never a man to forget a slight or grandstanding behavior, Truman was deeply upset that MacArthur had publicly questioned the president's foreign policy in the Pacific as a strategy of appeasement and defeatism, a matter that was read into the official congressional record. This behavior reinforced Truman's initial misgivings about MacArthur's ego, which he felt was out of control. The general did not return phone calls, thinking it beneath his position as head of state. When asked to brief U.S. State Department officials about the crisis in Korea, MacArthur's response was telling. "Why, as a sovereign, should I? President Truman doesn't do so, nor does the King of England or any other head of state." The tide of the Korean War turned against MacArthur following the Wake Island meeting. Chinese forces joined the North Koreans to halt the American advance. In defiance of direct orders from Truman, MacArthur sought to expand the size of the war by pushing north into China to confront the invading communists. On April 5, 1951, in direct contravention of the wishes of President Truman, MacArthur authorized a penetrating American strike into China. By this time, MacArthur's immense popularity made the decision to fire him a political liability, but Truman was unfazed. Calling a meeting of his top advisors on April 6th, he broached the topic of dismissing the vaunted general. At stake was the question of whether or not civilian authorities had a say in military policy. It was clear that MacArthur planned to fight the war in Korea and China on his terms, without heed to the authority of the President of the United States. Footnote: Truman's feelings about MacArthur's defiance are stated in a letter written by Truman and owned by Bill O'Reilly, which is included in this book. End footnote. The Joint Chiefs of Staff soon weighed in, favoring the dismissal of MacArthur for insubordination. On April 7th, Truman wrote in his journal of the Joint Chiefs that, "It is the unanimous opinion of all that MacArthur be relieved. All four so advise." But on April 11, 1951, when Truman formally announced that he was relieving MacArthur of command, there was an enormous public outcry of support for the general. Truman's public opinion rating once again tanked. Nevertheless, at 8 p.m. Washington time on April 11th, MacArthur was sacked. Truman had authorized his Secretary of the Army, Frank Pace Jr., to deliver the news, but Pace did not receive the order. Instead, MacArthur heard about his firing on the radio while eating lunch with his wife in Tokyo. This marked the end of Douglas MacArthur's military career. He returned home a hero, feted by a parade in New York City viewed by more than 7 million people that wound through 19 miles of Manhattan streets. More than 3,000 tons of paper were dropped from windows, balconies, and rooftops. Meanwhile, there were calls for Truman to be impeached. His approval rating dipped to 22%, forcing him to decide against running for re-election in 1952. Douglas MacArthur lived out the rest of his life in luxury, residing with his wife and son in a penthouse atop the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City. In 1962, he gave his legendary Duty, Honor, Country speech at West Point, concluding with the words, "The shadows are lengthening for me. The twilight is here. My days of old have vanished, tone and tint. They have gone glimmering through the dreams of things that were. Their memory is one of wondrous beauty, watered by tears and coaxed and caressed by the smiles of yesterday. I listen vainly, but with thirsty ears, for the witching melody of faint bugles blowing reveille, of far drums beating the long roll. In my dreams I hear again the crash of guns, the rattle of musketry, the strange, mournful mutter of the battlefield. But in the evening of my memory, always I come back to West Point. Always there are echoes and re-echoes. Duty. Honor. Country. Today marks my final roll call with you, but I want you to know that when I cross the river, my last conscious thoughts will be of the Corps and the Corps and the Corps. I bid you farewell." Douglas MacArthur died on April 5, 1964, of primary biliary cirrhosis, a disease of unknown origin that destroys the bile ducts in the liver. He was 84 years old. Before burial, his body lay in state in the Capitol Rotunda, where an estimated 150,000 people waited in line to pay their respects. Harry Truman's habit of long daily walks and drinking healthy doses of branch water and bourbon resulted in a long and prosperous life. He died on December 26, 1972, at the age of 88. His wife Bess died 10 years later. Both are buried at his presidential library in Independence, Missouri. Letter from Harry Truman. The White House, Washington, April 26, 1951. Dear Russ, your letter of the 12th interested me tremendously, and I also want to thank you for sending me the original of Jacob Burke's cartoon. I need not tell you that I am grateful for your favorable comments concerning the replacement of General MacArthur and the speech of explanation to the American people. It seems to me that everyone who stops to think should understand that under our constitutional system, military commanders are subordinate to civil authority. I am very glad that you wrote me, and your prayerful wishes are especially appreciated. Very sincerely yours, Harry Truman. Mr. Russ Stewart, General Manager, Chicago Sun-Times, 211 West Wacker Drive, Chicago 6, Illinois. Letter from Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter. This is an excerpt from A Full Life. I haven't changed my mind. We were again at sea about a year later when we sat on deck and listened to President Truman's nasal voice announce over the loudspeaker that a formidable weapon had been dropped on Hiroshima and that he hoped this would convince the Japanese to surrender. All of us agreed with his decision because it was generally believed that 500,000 Americans would have been lost in combat and many more Japanese killed if we had invaded the Japanese homeland and it was defended with suicidal commitment by Japanese troops on the ground. We were disappointed when we didn't return to port in time to join in the celebration when Japan surrendered just a few days later. Sincerely, Jimmy Carter. Letter from George Bush. George Bush, January 5th, 2016. Dear Bill, in response to your question, I think Harry Truman did the right thing. Thousands of Americans would have died invading Japan, maybe even me. My squadron was training for the invasion and close to shipping out again when Harry dropped the bomb. So would I have done the same thing? I think so. At that time, it was the right decision. Tough, but right. I hope this helps. Happy New Year. Sincerely, G. Bush. Mr. Bill O'Reilly, Anchor, Fox News Channel, 1211 Avenue of the Americas, 17th floor, New York, New York, 10036-8795.